Next case for argument is 21-2246, Minerva Surgical v. Hologic. Give you some time to get settled here. Appreciate people being patient waiting for the exit. Okay, Mr. Betty.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning, and may it please the Court. Rob Hockman from Minerva. I'm going to begin by addressing the invalidity issue, and then I'll turn to the Daubert and equivalence issue. Of course, I'm happy to turn to equivalence anytime you'd like. Now, on invalidity, I think it's fair to say after the briefing that Hologic and the District Court's reasoning don't get off the ground unless the 42017 steel device was ready for patenting, and it wasn't. And on that basis alone, you can vacate the invalidity judgment. Indeed, as we maintain in our brief, on that basis alone, you should order summary judgment of no invalidity on remand. I do also want to emphasize we have two other arguments on invalidity. There's more than enough evidence that the 42017 steel design was not brought to the conference.
But there is some evidence that perhaps they weren't ready, correct?
They were not.
You're just ignoring that there's another side, that there's another body of evidence that perhaps suggests that they were ready.
So what I think was ready was further research. That's literally the only evidence they have. And let me explain that, because I think when you focus on the ready for patenting issue.
Well, in particular, the requirement, the SDMP requirement, that was known, and there's evidence that indicates that you knew about that before the conference.
It was conceived at best, but it was not ready for patenting. As this court cases make clear, cases like Barry.
Well, you have to get ready for patenting. It just has to be different materials. And in this case, there were different alloys.
That's quite the contrary. Ready for patenting is an absolute requirement of 102B. That's what FAF and Invitrogen say. If the invention is not ready for patenting,
it's not. I think that Judge Reyna was suggesting that the only thing that was required was that there be two different materials of two different sizes, and that was already set forth in numerous documents. So I don't think he was saying that ready for patenting is not a requirement.
Right, but what's required for ready for patenting is more than just what's claimed. That's the Honeywell case. It's very clear on that.
Okay,
as well.
So what specifically are you arguing?
Yeah, and so what
does ready for patenting mean?
In this context, from Barry and Manville Sales and Polara, I think this court's cases are clear. Inventors need to be confident that their inventions, when used in the intended environment, are safe. And that's what's missing in this case. All of the evidence says, okay, we've got this idea, but the frame keeps deforming. We'll get there, but it's going to take time. And when you look at their evidence,
Counselor, there was more than an idea at the conference. There was an instrument there.
Yeah, but it was an instrument that was capable of.
But there was more than an idea, correct?
Right, but it was an idea for a frame at least. There are two inventions, right? There's the plasma heat source that was functioning. Then there's the frame element, and the frame element was deforming, and that was the problem that persisted, mind you, for more than a year after the conference. After the conference, here's the key fact that they cannot address, and they never address. At no time was the 42017 steel device design ever used in a live patient. And that's the intended environment of this invention. It says so right at the beginning of the summary invention. This is for use in a human female.
Does the claim say that? The claim says it's a preamble only, and it says, I believe it says an ablation device.
It's an endometrial ablation device.
A system for endometrial ablation. And then nowhere else in the claim is it mentioned. When I look at ready for patenting, am I supposed to go beyond the claim?
You're supposed to consider the intended use in the intended environment. That's what Polara and Manville says. Polara, right, you've got this signal.
So your view is that for any medical device, it's not going to be ready for patenting until there's human experimentation?
Until you know it's going to be safe to use in the intended environment? Absolutely.
So that means you need FDA approval?
Well, not necessarily FDA approval, but the patentee has to be far enough along that the patentee is confident. And again, take a look at Polara. That's not even a medical device case, right? That's a don't walk signal, right? And they've got to be sure it's going to work in all conditions. So they test it in some generally pleasant weather conditions. It works. And then they have to test it still in weather conditions that are fierce. Because they know from, as a, when you're dealing with-
What's the case law? The case law says without undue experimentation. The case law doesn't preclude further experimentation. It uses the word undue experimentation.
Agreed.
Correct? And why, given the claim language, as Judge Stoll pointed out, does what you're saying wasn't shown?
Because the undue experimentation language is for priority. And that's a fundamental confusion. In priority cases, that's Marikar. That's what they cite in Marikar. Marikar is a priority case. And in priority cases, you can have priority with conception so long as there's diligence in reducing to practice. Pfaff and Invitrogen say that's not true for 102B.
What about Hamilton Beach that talks about fine-tuning? Something could be ready for patenting even if there's fine-tuning.
I agree, but it's well beyond fine-tuning on this record, and certainly on this record, a jury could conclude that it's well beyond fine-tuning. Remember,
what about the bill of materials and very specific diagrams depicting, you know, the dimensions as well as the materials?
Of course, because when you're experimenting, you've got to build things to experiment with. So, yes, they could build something. It just would deform. And if it deforms during use, it's not ready for patenting because you can't get it out of the patient under those circumstances, or it's not safe to get it out of the patient.
So do we have cases, any of our case laws say that a device is not ready for patenting until all the experimentation has taken
place? No, and that's not my position. It's absolutely
not. It sounds
not
like
position.
Your position.
No. My position is you have to be confident it can be safely used in the intended environment. You can still fine-tune after that, but there's a point. There's a point before fine-tuning where you know you what you have. Consider this. The 4-2017 steel design, if that's all we have.
What are the extirpated uteri study?
Yeah, that's the brochure. So extirpated uteri are uteri that have already been removed from a live patient. And if you look at that, that's 12-175 to 76 of the record. If you look at that, what you see is there's a discussion of an experiment on 13 extirpated uteri, as I said, removed from patients, so not the intended environment.
That's a human flesh, though, right?
Right, but it's not in a live patient.
It's not a live patient.
Right.
But
so you can test, so it's a good way to test whether you have successful ablation, but it's not a great way to test whether you have safe removal.
The only testing left, in your view, was that it had to be tested on live patients.
Yes, I think that's absolutely essential.
Doesn't the investigators for sure indicate that it had been used in clinical studies?
No. It suggests that on the next step, it might be ready for the next step, further research in prehysterectomy studies. That's what it says. It says it had been used in 13 extirpated uteri. 11 of those were safely removed, still not the intended environment. And it suggests the next step of research would be appropriate. And here's the key. The next step of research that document anticipates did not happen for more than a year. More than a year. And the inventor, Mr. Toth, they point to his testimony. Oh, and by the way, the 4-2017 steel device has never once, that design has never once, to this day, been tested in a live patient. So what you would have to say is that, and we don't know to this day, nobody, including the inventors, can be confident to this day that design could have been patented. They needed to do more to be able to be sure it could be used in its intended environment. And the only way you get to invalidity is if you throw away cases like Barry and Manville Sales and Polara, and you allow and you encourage premature patenting before you have confidence that you have a device that's actually useful. Because after all, utility is required. It's not useful to have a device that's going to deform. And consider Mr. Toth's testimony at 6645. The deformation, the frame, that frame design deformed too much. The issues were too serious to use in going forward tests, and they didn't use them in going forward tests. And they didn't even do a test on a live patient for more than a year. I don't think the priority case requirement that the diligence in reducing the practice applies, but even if it did, another full year of trial and error before you could get there is far too much. And more importantly, it's not the right standard. That's what Pfaff and Invitrogen make clear. If there are no further questions on this, I'd like to turn to the equivalence issue. On equivalence, the district court's Daubert ruling comes down to a vitiation argument. Unless Dr. Bryant's equivalence analysis amounts to claim vitiation, a jury should hear it. So let's look at the district court and Hologic's reasoning. The claim language, substantially dissimilar material properties, has been construed to mean different thicknesses and different compositions between the inner and outer flexures. We agree, Dr. Bryan agrees. Hologic's device uses different thicknesses, and Hologic's device uses the same composition between inner and outer flexures. We agree, Dr. Bryan agrees. The difference is, Hologic and the district court say, that's all you need to know, because the same composition cannot be equivalent to a different composition. And emphatically, that is contrary to this court's cases on vitiation. It is exactly the kind of shortcut reasoning that this court has said in Bio-Rad, Edgewell, Ethicon, Deere & Company is inappropriate. And here's why. It destroys the whole doctrine of equivalence entirely. It is always possible.
So our law is somewhat confused in this area. And I'm intrigued by your expert's theories on vitiation and what occurred. But I'm not sure that the correct arguments were made below. You know, so can you just very concisely tell me what the problem is here?
Yeah, so fundamentally the problem is this. The reasoning of the district court is that a claim that requires A plus B is always cannot mean that A without B is an equivalent. And that's the shorthand. That's the shorthand that doesn't work, and that's not what Dr. Bryant did.
I read the district court's opinion slightly differently than you. One thing the district court said was, because your expert said, I think it was something like, the claim construction doesn't matter, is exactly what he said. He said, then the district court said, this testimony would be confusing to a jury.
Well,
that to me in Virtual 403, right?
I wasn't
looking at it the same way as you. You seem to be looking at it, you know, per se, almost as if it's a summary judgment analysis. You know, oh, this testimony cannot per se prove that there is infringement under the doctrine of equivalence. But I think there was more to it than that.
Well,
I think it was, yeah. If you read the district court's opinion, they're just talking about confusing to the jury because of the way the claim construction was said, that it could be disregarded or that it doesn't matter.
That was the district court's interpretation of Dr. Bryant's testimony. I don't think it's a fair one.
Yeah, but it's the district court's analysis, and your job here is to explain to
us. But the
district
court's
wrong
about
why the district court abused its discretion.
So as I said, Dr. Bryant accepts the district court's claim construction. He does so expressly, and the whole passage, and you should read, I mean, it's worth reading the whole section.
Why did the district court abuse its discretion in excluding his testimony?
Because he did not, first of all, he did not ignore the district court's claim construction. He said it. And the district court's claim construction is this. It requires different thicknesses and different compositions, right? Dr. Bryant explains that there are different bulk thicknesses between Hologic's, and everybody agrees on this, Hologic's inner and outer flexures, but that instead of different compositions, it uses a different geometry. It just substitutes a change in the geometry of the inner flexure for a change in the composition. And he says, that's elementary. That's not, Judge Stoll, that's not ignoring the district court's claim construction. That's taking it. It's doing exactly what an ideal doctrine of equivalence case does. It says, here's your construction, here's the difference, and here's why that difference is insubstantial. And it achieves the same function, the same way to achieve the same result.
What about where he said, by having a combination of dissimilar material properties, as one non-limiting example, different thickness and different composition. And you say non-limiting. He says non-limiting. That does, I mean, the court's construction was it has to be different thickness and different composition. So why is that non-limiting?
Well, it's non-limiting when you get to an equivalence analysis is the point, is what he's saying. I think he's not using it in a technical sense. I think what he's saying is when you get into equivalence, the question is there a way to achieve the same, to apply the function way result test to this construction that doesn't give you in exactly the same way. You don't use different compositions. You use different geometries.
I understand what you're saying, but about if the district court judge then says, I look at this and in my experience, I think the jury would be confused by this.
Okay. If this court's opinion is that, I don't think it's accurate to say, I think the district court erred to the extent he believed that it was simply contradicting his claim construction. It was applying the doctrine of equivalence as this court has required it exactly the way I think is appropriate. But putting that aside, if this court on remand wants to say, sure, absolutely, do not permit him to say the district court's claim construction is wrong, and he can say everything else he says, then that's fine. That's what he's going to do.
Can I ask you another question? I have an important question I want to ask you. It's kind of troubling me about the record before you run out of time, which is you argued on appeal on the public use issue that the SDMP aspect of the device wasn't visible to a person of ordinary skill in the art. And you cite a number of cases to support that. One concern I had is I went back and pulled your briefing before the district court on that issue, and I don't see where you presented that argument at all or presented those cases to the district court. You know, cases like the great varietal case.
Yeah.
And I see where you made other arguments, but this argument wasn't expressly made in the briefing.
Well, I think we did make the argument that we made the general argument. It may not have been made as articulately, may not have been made as clearly, but I think it was enough to preserve the general argument that there was a mere display and not use. And
I hear what you're saying, mere display, not use. But that's different than nobody could see the differences between the inner and outer frame.
I think it's just true, but I don't see much of a difference, actually. Because I think it's just a component, it's just another point. To the extent that they're pressing that this model was up there, there's no reason why a jury would have to conclude that that was done.
Okay, you've exceeded your time.
Yeah, I apologize.
We still have a little rebuttal, and let's hear from Mr. Wolf. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Matthew Wolf for Hologic. I'll start where my esteemed colleague started, which is invalidity. Ready for patenting, the Supreme Court has told us there are multiple ways to prove ready for patenting. One of them is drawings and descriptions sufficient for you to make the invention. This argument, the district court expressly found that this prong was met based on this as well as the reduction to practice approach to establishing ready for patenting, and this was waived. There is not a mention in the opening brief by Minerva that rejecting, challenging in any way, suggesting the district court got this analysis at 820 wrong. So ready for patenting, that argument where counsel started, was waived. On reply, you heard and saw the citation to Pallera and Manville and Honeywell. I would note for your honors that those are experimental use cases. There was no experimental use argument made below. There was no experimental use argument made in the opening briefs or indeed in the reply briefs. Pallera lays out a 13-prong analysis, which I'm sure your honors are familiar with. Not all are relevant in all circumstances. But experimental use in any event is a response to the second question, whether there's been a public use, not first whether there was ready for patenting. So, argument number one on ready for patenting is it has been waived because the district court found, and it was not challenged, that there were drawings and descriptions sufficient before the public use for there to be found that the invention was ready for patenting. Now, as to the question of, let's assume they hadn't waived it, let's assume that hadn't been even adopted by the district court, that the district court had just talked about reduced to practice. Your honors, I'd like to turn your attention to the section entitled Conclusion on A12176. Your honors asked about this and counsel cited it. Conclusion. This is in an FDA-mandated document that was created the very week of the trade show at issue. FDA mandated. Conclusion. The results of this range-finding study, Your Honor, that's the extirpated uteri you were talking about. The results of this range-finding study confirm that the Minerva device would be considered acceptable for clinical use in pre-hysterectomy cases. For clinical use. So not only did they say it probably worked, they were telling potential investigators for the clinical trial they were anticipating that they believed it was acceptable not for preclinical use, not for further experimentation, not hypothetically, not subject to further work. It was acceptable now for clinical use.
At the conference, were the attendings able to manipulate the device and use it? And if I recall correctly, in doing so, I think a hinge was broken on one or more.
On one of them, that's right, Your Honor.
The frame.
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, at A12189, there's an email from one of the sales reps summarizing the interaction between the physicians and the 15 devices that were there. And the headline, quote, devices have been working well, end quote. Pretty good evidence of what was going on. But Your Honor noted that they weren't perfect yet. There was one device, the hinge broke. So the devices were working well, but they're not perfect yet. I would note on the second public use prong, we again have a waiver issue. There are two ways, at least two ways, you can use public use. You can prove public use. One is commercial exploitation. The second is accessibility to the public. The district court expressly found both prongs were met, commercial exploitation and availability to the public. And the commercial exploitation prong was not challenged in the opening brief here. At A20, the district court expressly found Minerva commercially exploited its invention before the critical date, primarily in its efforts to sell the device to competitors like Johnson & Johnson, Covidien, and my client, Hologic. And this is at A12091. You see the internal reporting of these very commercial efforts. And what was said in the opening brief in response? Nothing. So this too was waived. In other words, one way of proving prong one was waived, one way of proving prong two was waived, we're done. The patent is invalid. The only response in the reply brief, which of course is too late anyway, but the only response to this is a throwaway sentence citing alloyed colloids, which said, quote, testing does not convert an otherwise experimental purpose into a public use. But of course, Minerva's meetings with Johnson & Johnson and Covidien, Hologic, and Conceptus the week before, those weren't experimental uses. They were trying to sell the product. They were trying to cash out. That's the very definition of a commercial use. They commercially exploited their invention or attempted to sell it. They were unsuccessful at the time. So prong one, or rather prong two, the first way to prove prong two, has been satisfied, in fact, has been waived.
Can we go back to the ready for patenting?
Yes,
Your Honor. Is your understanding that their argument is it's not an actual reduction to practice unless you've entered human clinical trial phase of development?
That seems to be the case, Your Honor, because, I mean, I just quoted.
And why is that wrong under the cases they cite, whether they're, even if they're in gray and not in blue, although they do cite Berry in blue?
They do, Your Honor. Now, in fairness, remember, there are two different ways to prove this, right? Description, waived. So we're just kind of putting that aside for the moment. That has to be wrong. I mean, you can imagine claim language. In fact, Berry implicates some claim language, where there is a standard or something that you have to get to before you've shown the invention has actually been reduced to practice. I have a microwave that needs to get to 200 degrees. That's a limitation. Until you prove it gets to 200 degrees, it's not reduced to practice, at least potentially. Here, as Your Honor pointed out, this is a straightforward apparatus claim with a straightforward set of limitations. That
sounds like the motionless keyboard case, where it included a requirement that the keyboard actually transmit a signal, and so there was no showing of the transmitting of the signal, so therefore it wasn't a public use.
Right.
Would you say that's analogous to what you're talking about?
Where, hypothetically, it would not be a reduction of practice, but this case is very much like the art.com case, right? Or art plus com. I assume that's how you say it. I recognize it's non-precedential, but it's very close to the facts of the circumstance. Where a prior art device was ready for patenting when a prototype of the device demonstrated the workability of the invention. I mean, that language is pretty close to what, and I won't repeat it too much, but the review from the trade show where he said these are working fine except there's the one that had the hinge break, that's almost verbatim what Art Plus Com says you need to have.
Would you say that there could be some circumstances in which you would have to have clinical testing before it would be ready for patenting?
So clinical testing, of course, Your Honor, has very specific meaning, right? It means in a live human being as opposed to a dog or a cat or a mouse. It means in certain controls. The FDA has defined what clinical means. If you mean it broadly, I can imagine circumstances where a claim is written where you have to prove something works beyond just on the benchtop. I can imagine claim language. That's not here. I could imagine it. Whether there would ever be a circumstance where actual clinical testing was required, as the FDA defines it and as counsel's using that term, I don't think so. I can't imagine what it would be.
There couldn't be claim language that was explicit enough to require
it. I guess if you said, you know, suitable for FDA approval or something like that.
Or what about suitable for human use or will accomplish this X in a human, something like that.
Yeah, I guess, but again, the FDA allows you to prove something suitable for human use, at least for study purposes, by performing it in analogous animals. So I can imagine, like at one extreme, you could get there, but there are a lot of interim steps. And of course, here we have, in their own words, in the very week of the study, you have them saying it's acceptable for clinical use. So we're not within, you know, wherever we are on the continuum, you know, in these hypotheticals, we're on the entire other side of the page in the facts of this case.
Can I ask you one more thing real quickly about your waiver argument respect to ready for patenting? I'm just having a hard time seeing it. And I look at their brief on page 55, for example, and they do talk about the documents. I'm having a hard time seeing why you think that they didn't say enough. They've got multiple pages devoted to the ready for patenting argument.
They have multiple pages on the reduced to practice prong of a possible. So remember, two ways, just documents, descriptions, reduced to practice. They have multiple pages about reduced to practice. We're not arguing they waived, we say they're wrong, we're not arguing they waived the reduced to practice.
No, but as Judge Stoll is pointing out, starting at page 53, we're talking about ready for patenting.
Right, but all of that, Your Honor, is going to, if I'm recalling correctly, all of that is about use on humans, right? It's all about the use idea. That it hasn't been proven it's useful. That's not a component. That's not a requirement. That's not a response to the drawing sufficient to practice way of showing ready for patenting. So even if we say that it was a failure of subtitling or of captioning or of labeling, they don't respond to the argument. If I write down the invention, if I write it down sufficient that one can practice, and remember the district court specifically found here there was more detail in these August documents than there were in the patent itself, that if I write that down such that one of skill in the art can make the invention, we don't even get to the reduction of practice prong, and then it doesn't matter whether it's ready for humans or not. Then the only argument they would have left is the experimental use argument when it comes to the public use prong. I think I used the word prong incorrectly there, Your Honor, but I think you get my point. They really did waive this. They really were responding to the second way you can prove ready for patenting, substantively and in name. And if we could talk, unless Your Honors have any more questions about the validity, Your Honor's absolutely right. I had in highlighting before Your Honor brought it up, Bryant said as one non-limiting example, but it's not just Dr. Bryant, I mean, even in the reply briefs themselves, reply 29, nothing in the claim construction ruling suggests that these two requirements follow from the claim language itself. Well, of course they do. That was the claim construction. That's the unchallenged claim construction here. And that was the kind of rhetoric both in the briefing and in Dr. Bryant's report that troubled the district court. You are disregarding my claim construction at every step of the way. That's what the district court is saying. Now, to Your Honor's vitiation point, so we agree that in terms of the actual posture, this being the exclusion of an expert report, the district court was plainly within its rights. But to turn to the vitiation point, Your Honor, we have kind of an insult and an injury here. We have a claim that says for element A, you can use any composition under the sun for the first frame element. For frame two, let's call them frame one and frame two. For frame two, you can use any composition under the sun with one exception. You can't use the same thing you used for A. And what they've now done is said, well, you can also use the same one you used for the frame one. That is the very definition of vitiation. They have now said that composition language is gone because it originally said everything but one, and now we're saying everything including one. That's the insult. The injury here.
So assuming that there was vitiation, right, are you arguing that in such cases there can never be a DOE finding?
Your Honor, I am relying heavily on the language of Moore and Augme. When Moore said, for this reason, referring to the obviousness of the alternatives, quote, many limitations warrant little, if any, range of equivalence. The injury here is that, remember, the first part of the claim construction is different thickness. So you have to have different thickness and different composition. What they suggested, what Dr. Bryant suggested below, was the different composition was the different thickness. That's the equivalent. So not only have you said we can use any composition at all, vitiating that, we're saying the way you do it is with a limitation that's already in the claim. And so when Moore and Ogme says equivalency cannot embrace structure that is specifically excluded from the scope of the claims. And here we see element one, frame element one, use anything. Frame element two, use anything but what you used for frame element one.
Do you have an answer to my question?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Okay. If in situations where you have vitiation such as here, are you saying there can never be an equivalency finding?
If you've completely vitiated the claim, then I would say Moore and Ogby stand for the proposition that you're done. There can't be equivalency.
Just to be clear, though, this is your vitiation theory is not based on the claim language itself so much as the interpretation of that claim language. Just to be clear.
The unobjected to claim. In fact, this was...
Do you need that in order to be successful?
No, not at all. That's why I started with Your Honor's point. And frankly, we think in light of the invalidity ruling, we don't even need to get to the Bryant doctrine of equivalence.
I was going
to
ask that clearly. I mean, right? If we were to affirm hypothetically the 102B.
Then we're done, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I appreciate the opportunity. I'll be brief, Your Honor. On invalidity, here's the key thing. Ready for patenting, according to FAF, there are two ways to show ready for patenting. You can either do a device or drawings, but it has to be of the invention. And you do not have an invention, according to this court's case law, until you have something that's safe for use in its intended environment. The intended environment here is right at the top, the very first sentence of the summary of the invention. It is for the treatment. It's for the treatment of uterine diseases in human females. So if you can't confidently get the device out of a live patient, you do not have this invention.
So
and
in
unless
words,
you're going to throw away Honeywell.
Can I just ask, my question is, so in other words, what you're saying is that you're prepared drawings, there are in fact drawings, but those, your argument is that those drawings can't be relied on because there was no human use or knowledge.
They are not the invention. And we know they are not the invention. Partly because, on the one hand, the inventor said they were still deforming too much. But on the other hand, because we know they were never even tried in those further experiments that 12176 refers to, we didn't do it with this device. We didn't do it with that drawing. And we took another year, more than a year. This didn't happen right away. So when you put all the evidence together, I don't see how you could say a jury would be at least precluded from saying this device just wasn't ready yet. They didn't have, whatever drawings they had, they weren't for something that could be used in a human being. And until they believed...
Can you just speak briefly to the waiver argument?
Yeah, so as for the waiver argument, I mean, as you said, I mean, it's a heading that the ready for patenting is a full-on heading of our brief at page 53. So that whole section addresses the ready for patenting issue in general. And as for the specific drawings, we talk about that on page 46, that the drawings show only conception, not reduction to practice. That's also clear. So, and again, the solution to all of the waiver arguments is the same. Ready for patenting is a prerequisite. You don't, until you have either a drawing or a device, that reflects the invention, something safe for use for its intended purposes, you haven't satisfied the FAF requirement of ready for patenting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank both sides in the case is submitted.